it's just a wonderful time to be out in the outdoors, working in the flower beds, working in the vegetable garden, or looking at your trees and shrubs and maybe doing a little work around them. Well, I have a guy with me who can help you out in a lot of those areas anyway, Ed Lyons. Ed Lyon is the director of the Allen Centennial Gardens on the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus, here to offer his advice on questions relating to your plants. Ed, thank you.
Oh, you're quite welcome. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Oh, and I'm telling you, walking by the Allen Centennial Gardens, it is so beautiful. You want to walk right in. It's just gorgeous right now. And you're also doing some renovating. You're renovating the ponds. And by the way, if you're not familiar with the location of the Allen Centennial Garden, it's right on the UW-Madison campus, and we have a link on my Facebook page. So if you want, just go to the Larry Mueller Show, click on that link. It'll show you a map, essentially, somewhere on that page, how you can get to it.
Yep, correct. And our big project, the major project this year, is the renovating the pond. We are 25 years old, so lots of celebrating for that. But in that time period, that pond has gone through three different liners. And it was originally built by a swimming pool company. So it was built more like a swimming pool with swimming pool filters and liners, straight sides. I've never have liked the appearance of it. So this year, when the liner gave way, that was a perfect opportunity to say, let's renovate it and turn it into a true pond. So we have ProScapes from a local business that are in. They started yesterday. They were in sucking out all of the muck from the bottom. They're pulling out the liner. But it will now be restructured with rock sides, rock bottom. Mm. We'll have a biofilter.
Oh, boy.
So a more sustainable way to then also keep the water clean and filtered. We'll now be able to have the water right up to the very top level. Oh. We don't have to drain it. $65,000 coming out of our endowment to pay for it. And it'll be a little stressful for the next couple of weeks while they do it. But when we get done, it'll be just spectacular.
Yeah, just spectacular. Well, we have some gardeners with questions for you, Ed. So I want to give Kathy first in Chippewa Falls the opportunity to join in. Kathy, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry, Ed. So happy to talk to you. We board horses and have the opportunity to have as much horse manure as we want for our new raised beds. And I've heard that you have to let it age to kill the seeds, and I'm just wondering if that's true because I don't want to have to start weeding those raised beds immediately.
Obviously, yeah, that's part of the reason to let it age, but it's not the whole reason. Also, fresh manure of any animal will also be much higher in nitrogen than you want it to be the first year. So you can actually literally burn plants by using too much manure if it hasn't been composted. And as far as eliminating weeds, you'll probably will never totally 100% eliminate them. But certainly the larger the pile, the more that pile heats up. It'll destroy a certain number of them. Keep in mind, some weeds are extremely resistant. They'll sit in the ground for years and can actually survive a fair amount of heat. But keeping the piles large, keeping them turned, and keeping them heated will definitely help in that situation.
Mm-hmm. So what's a good ratio? Like we have compost and then we have the manure if we were going to mix it.
Well, manure is actually compost.
Okay.
If you're talking true compost is decomposing organic matter, which is exactly what horse manure is. Now, sometimes people will tell you have compost, but there may also be topsoil that's mixed in it as well. How long are you aging the horse manure? Are you aging it? Horse doesn't take as long as cow.
We have our choice of piles.
Oh, okay.
Some are older than others.
Yeah, I mean, even a year old is fine. And
okay.
I think mixing about 20% in with your compost should be certainly fine. You don't want to overdo it.
Okay.
But
that sounds great.
Have you got some piles that are at least a year old?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
And even a little older, it's certainly not going to hurt if it's older.
And again, I used to go to neighboring horse farms and kind of made sure, because a lot, like you said, you have it in a pile. I would sort of dig away the exterior and dig as far into the interior as possible because it's more likely to be heated. Mm-hmm. And obviously you have more than you need, so go in toward the interior and use that.
That's exactly what I thought. We'd use the bucket on the tractor and take the top layer off and get that really dark stuff underneath.
That's what you want.
And then send some my way.
Thanks, Kathy.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. Appreciate the call. Oh, she's got a good thing going there. Deborah in Minocqua, we turn to you next. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. I have a large hydrangea bush. It's about 5 feet tall, and it's got the big white blossoms. I think they're called snowballs. And every fall, I cut it back all the way to the ground, and it comes back beautifully. But last fall, I didn't do that. And so now this morning when I went out, it's really still big, but it looked dead. So when I started to cut it back, I noticed these little green shoots on the end of the branches. And so now I don't know what to do. Do I just leave it, or can I still cut it back?
Okay, in the process of your describing this, I would think you have the hydrangea arborescens, which does die back to the ground, and that would be the one that then people, you know, would cut back. At this point, if it had been 2 weeks ago, I would have told you to cut it right down to the ground regardless. Are the leaves unfolding at this point?
Let me run out and look. Yes, they are.
Yeah, in that case, I might only take it down to about a third or so because it's already trying to photosynthesize. You might set it. They're extremely durable shrub. But at this point, I'm not sure I'd take it all the way down to the ground.
Okay, so about a third then.
Yeah, I'm leaving about a third.
And then do you think it's best to cut it back in the fall then instead of waiting till the spring like I did?
Fall or spring, either will work. There's really no difference between the two. The thing is if you do it in the fall, then you just don't risk forgetting in the spring.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot for calling. And we'll turn to Baraboo next and talk with Claire. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Larry. I have a very unexciting question.
Okay.
I have arborvita and U-type shrubs in my yard and even a baby pine tree. I'm not sure what variety it is.
And they're brown.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. the most often asked question.
It's not where the needles are brittle, because I know there's a certain amount of die-off each year. This almost looks like a disease.
No, conifers burned severely this winter. And when I say severely, I mean severely. It's been the most asked question that we've gotten in the gardens that I get personally. It's interesting, usually we hear the complaints with arborvitaes. Arborvitaes basically came through this winter swimmingly. And interestingly, it was the yews. And normally yews just don't burn to the degree they did this year. The yews, the yews, spruces, hemlocks, it literally has destroyed hemlocks and to a certain degree the pines. One of the problems is I think most homeowners understand the fact that the reason that deciduous trees drop their leaves is because then they don't lose any moisture through the winter. That's where they lose their moisture. But they forget that conifers, those needles are leaves. They're just a modified leaf. And that conifer still is losing moisture through the winter. And if it keeps transpiring out that moisture and it has frozen root systems, it has no way to replace that moisture. Generally, they can get through the winter with the amount that they have in them. Whenever you see burn, it's because all of a sudden now it's lost enough moisture. It can't replace that with the frozen root system. And this year we added to that severe wind burn. And we were very cold. A lot of wind. Now, the biggest problem we're having is with people with things like hedges. They want to go right in there and start trimming out that brown. We have a 25-year-old yew hedge at the gardens right now that looks just horrible. and there's nothing we can do. If you go in and you cut that brown off, that's where the growing points also are. So we literally have to hope that there's green growing points that are going to come through that brown and let the green grow out.
And, you know, as I've walked around our neighborhood, and because I walk every single morning at about 3 mile walk, I've seen that the pines and many of them are coming back. I mean, you can see the progression of them getting greener and greener as time goes on.
And pines in general will regenerate quicker than other plants. Now, we have a couple of spruces in the garden. They're putting out nice, fresh buds on the tips. The problem is they're going to lose every bit of the interior needles.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly, when you have to decide, well, am I going to wait 6 or 7 years for it to recover? Or at this point, should I just replace the tree because the damage is so bad?
Yes.
Because
so
when
where the damage has been done, there will be no green growth there ever.
Well, it depends on the plant that you're looking at. But if it's brown and dropping off in the interior, it is highly likely it will not, no.
Mm.
Like I said, this is probably one of the worst winters I've seen. We had a speaker come up and talk to us from southern Indiana. He said it was bad all the way down there. It wasn't just our area. It was very extensive this year.
Might still give it another week or two.
And that's the thing we're having the hardest time is getting people just simply to hold off and wait because conifers are much slower to react and recover than other trees are. And everybody wants to jump right out there and get rid of that brown.
Correct.
Yeah. Key is keep them well with a lot of water. Because
that was going to be my next question.
Yep.
Okay.
To give them every possibility. If they are going to regenerate, they're going to need the water to do that.
There you go.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Claire, thank you for calling. I really appreciate it. Wow. We're learning a lot here and having a good time talking about gardens, your garden and mine, with Ed Lyon, director of the Allen Centennial Gardens on the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus. I'm Larry Mueller. Carl Christensen, our on-air producer today here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest Ed Lyon, director of the Allen Centennial Gardens on the UW-Madison campus. Questions? Email us at talk@wpr.org. Call us at 1-800-642-1234 or post on my Facebook page. You can post a question or you can a photo, a gardening photo. Love those as well. And I'm just looking now. Kara sent us a photo of a climbing rose. And Ed, can you make that out?
Yeah, I can see it, and it always helps to know which rose that you're looking at. But certainly, that one's in good need of good pruning. So you're going to want to put on some good thick sleeves and heavy gloves. And most of your climbing roses, you get in there and start cutting back good and hard on them. They're going to generate new growth. And certainly it will be more juvenile growth that will put on more flowers as well.
So you whack that off maybe half?
I'd start the first year, probably going down maybe about half or so. But you want to make sure it does have enough vegetation to keep photosynthesizing and recover from that. A rose like that, I would probably be, if you really want it to be a good rose, you're going to go in there every year and cut out some of the older canes and keep generating some new canes. It's called rejuvenile pruning.
Let's take a call from Terry in Tomahawk next. Hi, Terry. Thank you for calling.
Yes. Good morning. I have a question for Ed, and I'd like him to make a comment. My question would be, at this time of the year, to control invasive woody plants such as I've got small cottonwoods, and I've got honeysuckle. What would be the best herbicide at this time of the year to use on the stump once they're cut? And I'd like Ed to make a comment on how kind of the general public is overusing Roundup.
Oh, well, Roundup won't work, for yeah. one thing. And yes, you're absolutely right. Roundup has become the Kleenex of pesticides. In other words, the general public thinks use it on everything and anything, and it is, it's a very specific herbicide. The chemical that I would use, and I know there's several out there, the one I know offhand because I've used it myself for stumps is Tordon, T-O-R-D-O-N. And again, apply it judiciously, apply it immediately after the cut. And you're just applying it to that cambium layer. Don't go just spraying it all over. We're trying to keep people from putting any more herbicides into the environment than we have to. Keep in mind, though, some plants, sumac is one of them, very, very resilient. And it may still take, they may still shoot up new shoots. And it could take several different cuttings and applications before you truly kill it with the herbicide even. I think a lot of people think you cut it, you put the herbicide on, it's instant death. And that doesn't always happen.
Yep, there you go. Thank you, Terry, for calling. And Sharon in Berlin, thank you for calling. Hi.
Good morning. Beautiful day out here. I'm outside and looking at things. My ewes came through the winter 100%. They're on the north side of the house. It's a two-story where they are. Two little low ones and one pyramidal. And they're just really unruly. Can I prune them now? And how severely can I prune them?
You can prune ewes at any time. Certain conifers that grow all through the season can be pruned at any time, unlike your spruces, pines, and firs that only put out growth once a year. So I wouldn't go in there and do a real heavy pruning at this point. I mean, we don't prune any of our ewes until we get into about August. Because, again, what you're going to be doing, now, there's a difference between if you're talking about shearing or if you're pruning to control size. And pruning is when you're cutting individual branches to control size. If you're if you're pruning, you can prune at any time. If you're shearing, you're shearing off every bit of that new growth, and you certainly wouldn't do that this time of year.
Okay. Right. Thank you very much.
Yep, thanks, Sharon. Barry in Wales, Wisconsin, hello to you.
Hi, how are you today?
Great, thanks a lot for calling.
Good. I am calling because we have, I think, a slug problem. A couple years ago, my husband and I set up a raised lasagna garden, where we layered nitrogen versus carbon materials to compost, and it's a really fertile garden. We put our plants in this year, and all of a sudden, they all have teeny tiny little holes in the leaves. So I think these are slugs. And
could be slugs, could be earwigs. Depending on what the plant is, I mean, almost every vegetable has some type of, there are various caterpillars, larvae of different moths and butterflies. What are the plants you're seeing the most damage on?
See, it's on the tomatoes, it's on almost everything, the lettuce, it's on pretty much everything that's in the beds. It's not on the things that we have in pots that are surrounding the beds.
Okay. I'm not quite sure it would be slugs as much as maybe earwigs or, you know, some of the other larvae of insects. If you are having a slug issue, Sluggo does work. It's expensive, but it's very effective. And this is only from my experience. Milorganite will not tell you this. But I have found that Milorganite tends to both deter the rodents. I use it for that respect. But I also have found that when I use it around hostas and plants that have earwig and slug problems, it seems to work the same as Sluggo does. That's just from my own personal experience.
What is that called again?
Milorganite. It's a fertilizer, low-grade nitrogen. I think it's about 7 to 9% nitrogen. It's actually produced from the Milwaukee Sewage District. You can find it in any of your garden centers or big box stores. I like it because it is a fertilizer. It's low grade. It's not going to burn anything. I use it for rabbit control. They don't like the odor. When I say odor, it's not fecal odor. You would think that right away because of coming from the septic. But the hard metals have been removed. That was one of the issues early on with using. But I find, it's not a chemical, and it works pretty well for me. But I really think what you're going to need to do, if you have the issue again this year, take pieces of some of those vegetables and get it to a diagnostic lab, because I can't accurately diagnose for you exactly what is causing those issues. And I think you want an accurate diagnosis based on somebody really seeing what you have.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do that from the leaf with the hole in it?
I think so, knowing what the vegetable is. And also your extension agents know what insects, what types of diseases are occurring. They'll put out reports and say, right now this is what we're seeing in diseases and insects. So that kind of timing and what plant you have it on will give them a good deal of information to say, such and such insects out right now. It's likely to be that.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call very much. And Tom in Fox Point has an issue. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how are you guys doing today?
Great. Thank you for calling.
Good. Well, you're welcome. I've got a question. Given this winter, we've had at the house some ornamental trees damaged relatively considerably by, rabbits, whatnot, bark girdling I'm talking about specifically. And I've got a Japanese maple that had the bark girdled over 50% of the trunk at the base. Now, I know that in many cases, given the extent of the damage, this tree could be a goner. I also know that there's a technique out there called bridge grafting, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that.
My thoughts are, if you want to play around and try it, but by all means do it. It's probably cheaper and more effective to go out and replace the Japanese maple. Now, if you've got a 20-year-old Japanese maple that you're absolutely in love with, and this is something that you feel that, I want to try this, I want to play around with it and see if it works, certainly, I think that would be a lot of fun. But in the same regards, if it's a younger Japanese maple, this is just not something that, you don't want to go to that kind of effort, then certainly Japanese maples don't cost nearly what they used to in the past. And And the thing is you may bridge graft it and lose it next year anyway, because certainly Japanese maple, we're out of the range of any reliable hardiness for them in the first place. So I think it's a lot of people like to try those kinds of things just to see if they can do them. And if that's a challenge you want to attempt, I think that would be wonderful. But otherwise, I'd probably replace the tree.
Well, there you go.
Okay.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks a lot for calling. We had an email from Gary in Iron River, who wanted you to please suggest what is good to plant in a crocus and daffodil bed to provide some color interest during the rest of the year. I'm in Bayfield County, zone 3-4, and live in the woods, so deer resistance is also important.
Well, first let's address deer resistance. There's only so much degree of that, and people want to think that deer all have identical tastes, and they're no different than you and I. Larry may very well love Brussels sprouts, and I hate them. So deer.
I do love Brussels sprouts.
Yeah, see, and deer are no different than we are. So I can't tell you plant, and anybody who's going to tell you a plant is deer resistant, remember the word is resistant, so it's not deer proof. Getting that out of the way, you have two of the most common plants that are available out there with literally thousands of cultivars that work great for this, and that are your hostas and your ferns. They are late emerging. They emerge after your daffodils and bulbs bloom. They fill in that space with wonderful color. If you're combining hostas with ferns, you're combining the two opposites in texture. you're fine with your course, which is also gives adds to design. And certainly there are many other woodland plants that would serve that same purpose. But those are probably two of the very most common and readily available. I use hostas very much around, especially things like lilies, which will leave behind that sort of ugly-looking stem. By the time the lilies are done blooming, that's when the hostas have really flushed out. I've even had people say, what are those gorgeous orange flowered hostas you have? But, yeah, those are two very common plants you could use right there.
Terry emailed us in from Blanchardville and wondered if you could put a raised bed under or around a walnut tree.
Well, certainly that's one of the ways to get around the julian is to have a raised bed. The depth of the raised bed is going to make a difference whether the julian still affects it. And keep in mind, it's not just the roots. Some black walnuts will literally drip and exude the julian and will drop from the air. Mm. Any of your walnuts that drop, leaves, stems. My backyard's under two black walnuts. And believe me, I'm constantly cleaning out the debris, and that has julian in it as well. So even though it's a raised bed, I'd still be reluctant to think you're going to be able to do plants that are extremely tolerant to julian. Mm-hmm. But it will certainly help for plants that are either moderately or not nearly as affected.
Just a little aside, black walnuts, again, have become a very expensive tree, a very profitable tree if you want to sell your black walnut tree. And it has spawned, once again, people coming into properties and cutting down somebody else's black walnut and dragging it away before the person knows that they're gone.
So, oh, my goodness. I actually thought that's how I'd get rid of my two, but mine are urban, and they decided it wasn't worth coming in and cutting them down and dealing with the urban environment. But
well, it's happening out in that in those rural counties or those rural areas, the forested areas where there's black walnut. Hmm. If I had any, I would be I'd be alert to that. Nikki in Green Bay, it is your turn. Hi, Nikki.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a secret garden. I just basically moved into this new house. Well, new for us in December. And now that things are finally coming up and growing, I noticed I have a couple rose bushes that are about 5 feet tall. And last year, it looks like some sort of bug must have gotten into, I don't know, the last bit of growing that came up last year. And it made this weird kind of ball. And I was wondering what that kind of bug might have been. It's and what I could do about it this year.
Yeah, if it's sort of a rounded ball on that the stem sort of expands out into.
Yeah.
There's a number of different insects that do that. Generally, they're perfectly harmless because all they've done is laid an egg or multiple eggs in there. It's going to turn into something that's a larva. It'll break open and off they go. So it's not really going to damage the roses. So I would simply cut them out. Most of those aren't actually damaging to the plant.
It looked like whatever was supposed to be growing after it had died off. So that's why I was kind of...
Then cut your branches down to an outward-facing bud.
Okay. Sounds good. I will do that.
Thank
you. And then
I
have one more question, if that's at all possible.
Sure.
Sorry. I have a tree that was put in, must have been a few years ago. It's just a little aspen. But when they put it in, they completely did the wrong thing with the mulch, brought it all the way up, and had black fabric completely around it. So some of the, basically, it's just gotten all of its roots. Wasn't able to breathe, and so it's wrapped its roots around itself and come up. And I was wondering, I know eventually that will actually kill the tree itself.
Yeah, it's called girdling, yep.
Yeah, so I've pulled the mulch back. and I've tried to cut, you know, the all of the roots that were coming up back and down as far as I could go, but I didn't really dig. What else can I do to help this tree survive?
There's not really a lot that you can do at this point. And it's interesting, we used to tell people, even when you're purchasing trees and they had the severely encircling roots, that, you know, you go in there, cut them when you go to plant the tree. And now research is showing this, that once a tree starts to do that circling, it's genetic, it starts to genetically implant in it. And I'll tell you, when I go to buy trees today, I will not buy one that the nurseries must just love me, because I'll pull it up enough out of the pot so I can see if it's very root-bound or not. I won't even touch them anymore, because research is showing you can go home and cut on those roots all you want, and it'll keep circling. They did some work up at Green Bay Botanic Garden and air-spaded trees that had been in for years, and they knew that they had done that with them, and they still continued to girdle. So the damage is, there's probably not a lot you can do now. You might talk to an arborist and have somebody actually come and look at the tree again. Many things are hard to diagnose and give you advice over the radio not seeing it. But certainly if it's a valuable tree to you, I'd have an arborist look at it. They might have some advice. Maybe some spading around it could help.
And there have been some, that from time to time you'll hear the suggestion that if it's done right, you'd want somebody who knew what they were doing actually cutting some of those roots that are in the process of girdling can extend their life.
Yeah, but I hate to tell a homeowner just go in there and start cutting
no,
away.
No, well, and I would definitely do it. But, I just... Thank goodness there's no stress on the tree now, but I know in a few more years, what's going to happen. So, well, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Holiday.
Thanks so much. To you as well, Nikki. Thank you so much for calling. Back to the Facebook page, because we have another photo, which is kind of interesting. It reminds me a little of my own property from Barbara.
That looks like maple seedlings.
He says a zillion maple trees in the yard, the gardens. Is it from the constant snow cover this past year, or what is it? I have more of these little maple seedlings than I think I've ever had.
I told you that my backyard was under black walnuts. My front yard is under silver maples, and this is a good year for them. It'll vary from year to year, and there's various things that will make a maple seed prolifically. Stress will do it. Anytime you stress any kind of plant, and this still might be the result of the drought, we're still seeing, I mean, you'll go several years down the line, and woody plants in particular may still be showing effects of that. But when a tree starts to stress, and we had a hard winter, it decides, well, if there's going to be survival for my species, I put out lots and lots of seed. And I find with my silver maples, it's like every other year. Now, next year, I may go out and not pull hardly a one. Unfortunately, I also get the neighbor's Norway maple seedlings, which are even harder to pull out. But it's a seasonal thing, and it all depends on the tree and the tree health as far as how many they put out. But like Larry, I've been pulling a lot of them myself this year.
It's from our neighbor's maple, silver maple, and they're I've noticed, though, that the roots on that are circling on that tree, so it's probably not going to be all that long for this world. But
and last year, I don't think I pulled hardly,
Pull any last year, I don't think. It was very, very few. Jill and Racine, thanks for calling. Hi.
I have a quick question. Do you think onion sets will grow under a black walnut?
I would be a little surprised you'd be growing vegetables under black walnut just because of the shade.
It's on the lot line and it hangs over, and hostas grow there.
Hostas will tolerate juglan, though. They may not achieve the size they would otherwise, but they are juglan tolerant. In all honesty, I've never checked to see whether onions are or not, because generally people aren't doing vegetable gardens anywhere near the walnut simply because of the shade it produces.
Okay. My real question was, I have an emerald euonymus that doesn't get enough sun.
Is this ground cover, or are you talking Euonymus acellata, the burning bush tree?
No, the green and pale around the edge of the leaves.
No, I'm asking, there's a purple Euonymus called emerald that's actually a ground cover. Or are you talking about the tree, shrub, form
the
of...
shrub.
Okay.
The hedge plant.
Okay, cut it right off at the base.
Okay.
I say
cut
that...
Cut it right off at the base.
Yes, I say that because the burning bush is a highly invasive plant in Wisconsin right now, and I have no use for that plant. And I think it should be cut off and replaced with plants that are invading our natural systems. That's probably not what you wanted to hear, though, was it?
The emerald Euonymus I should get rid of?
If you're talking about a burning bush, is that what?
No, this is green.
Yes, it's green in the summer, and then it turns, the reason it's called burning bush is it turns a pinkish red in the fall.
Yeah, this doesn't turn colors.
Okay,
well, that's different.
Yeah, we'd have to know what Euonymus that you're talking about.
Emerald Gaiety Euonymus.
Oh, that is not a tree and it's not a shrub. That's a ground cover. That's what I was asking before. Okay, now what is the question?
When I transplant it, it sends out branches that will root.
Uh-huh, that's what
do
they
I
do.
Give it a lot of room around it?
A fair amount, yes. And that's what it does. Every place that it sets a branch down, it'll root in. It's actually almost more of a vine. It's not a climbing, twining vine.
Right.
Yep.
All right. Thank you very much, Jill, for calling. Appreciate your call. Ed Lyon, our guest, director of the Allen Centennial Gardens on the UW-Madison campus. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Like a lot of our own family members, many of the herbs and vegetables in our summer gardens are European immigrants. They came to Wisconsin as seeds and cuttings, along with the people who came to call Wisconsin home in the 19th century. One of the places where you can see what those gardens look like is Old World, Wisconsin, in Eagle, Wisconsin. Old World's historic gardener, Marcia Carmichael, tells us about a few of these well-traveled plants.
I'm into my sixth year as historical gardener, and I still love it even when it's a hot summer. I'm not sure what the requirements are for the job, but love of the plants. Certainly for me, it's the love of all the different ethnic varieties that are out here and to be able to showcase what their strengths are and their charms and their characters and make each one speak for itself. Okay, just to let you know quickly the variety of things I picked this morning as I was traveling through the gardens. Lovage, a perennial celery-flavored plant, so often the leaves are used in soups and stews because they maintain a really nice flavor. Can be really large in the garden, so never for the front border of the garden, but he's this big, handsome guy who stands in the back, and it's one of those that, you know, early in the season people say, what is it? Because he's coming up and he's so robust. And it is also rumored that because the stems are hollow and they have a celery flavor that you could drink tomato juice or Bloody Mary through it like a straw. But of course, I wouldn't know from experience, right? We grow marshmallow, and it looks like a small hollyhock. And it's generally the roots that are used, and they have really emollient properties. So if you slice it up, it's slippery and really good for the digestive tract and good for cosmetic uses. And I believe the original marshmallows were made from the root of this plant. So we're thinking sometime, wouldn't it be fun? You know, see if we can whip something up. They're not used anymore, but it's for that purpose. But it's really fun to grow them and introduce people to a marshmallow. Brought rosemary, and we have myrtle growing in the front garden. Rosemary and myrtle were two plants that had strong roots in Europe for their great significance, that they were really special, and often pieces were brought to America when the people came. Rosemary for remembrance, and often used in weddings and funerals and baptisms and things that had special family significance. And then the myrtle plant signified peace and love in the household, so often they were grown near the entry of the house and supposed to protect the house sort of from evil things. and considered really special. There's a lot of reference to bringing seeds from home and tubers and cuttings and little pieces. Probably not a lot of large plants were transported because there was so much that had to be brought with people. But there are even references to rose bushes traveling across the country by covered wagon and ox cart. And you think about that, and these are roses that probably a slip had come from the homeland, and that it was just that touch of home, so that when the women especially came not knowing what they were going to find, and they were going to be homesick and would miss all the things they'd left behind and had no idea if there would be anything quite this beautiful or this special. So a little piece of, you know, what mother had grown or grandmother had grown at home that they could continue to grow here. And sometimes they came in by in a broken teapot or came in a kettle or, you know, how they transported their plants. And they cared enough about them to pass that story on, you know, I think is really neat.
What a fascinating story. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. And, you know, you can watch more Wisconsin Life. Just go to Wisconsin Public Television Mondays at 8 p.m. For more information, visit our website at wisconsinlife.org and find them on Facebook. Thank you so much for listening into this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller with my guest today, Ed Lyon, director of the Allen Centennial Gardens. Always great to have him along. The gardens are so wonderful, right on the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus. I hope you'll go to their page, their website. You can find it at my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and you're going to find out a lot of things there. There's some wonderful photos of the gardens and events, and you always have some great events every year at Jim in La Crosse. Has a question for you, so let's go to him. Hi, Jim. Thank you for calling.
Hey, Larry. Hey, Ed.
Good hey, is your snow gone yet?
What's that?
I said, is your snow gone yet? You folks had snow long after we did.
So I guess I'm looking at two normal-sized lilac bushes, full-grown, 8-9 feet, 4 feet in diameter, and about 10 feet apart from each other, and I'm trying to keep them in their own little clump. And so I guess I'm in the nature of which one, what part of the tree do I want to groom and that kind of thing.
Yeah, standardly. And it's interesting because we did, and mentioning Jeff Epping, he just came and gave a talk to my volunteers and members. We do classes for them all winter long. Uh-huh. And it was interesting, it's the first time I heard this, and he says that the whole pruning after flowering is actually more of a myth, and not to let that hold you back on pruning trees of that nature. But certainly on lilacs, what you want to be doing is you're taking out that really older growth, the big larger wooded portions of the plant, because the older that wood gets, the less it's flowering. It's more that juvenile growth that does the maximum flowering for you.
Right. And then do you want to cut them right at the base?
Yeah, you want to cut them right off at the base.
Okay.
And then you also take out, if it's doing a lot of suckering, then you certainly want to cut a fair amount of those suckers out as well. So what you're trying to do is you're getting this balance of that sort of in between. You're taking out the very old wood, but you're also getting rid of that, the extensive number of suckers that many common lilacs have.
Right.
So you're taking out about a third, you said? And
yeah.
So every 3 years, you've pretty much eliminated all?
You've kind of rejuvenated the whole tree.
Okay, so I want to pull out about a third of the tree.
Yeah.
Or a third of the bush.
Especially if you haven't been doing this on a regular basis. I bought a farm in upstate New York years and years ago in a past profession. Massive, absolutely gorgeous lilac hung over the road, and I was commenting on it, and all the neighbors says, oh, that hasn't bloomed in years and years. Well, I went in there and I cut out all of the major old growth, cut out the suckers, and the next spring that thing was just spectacular. They thought I was a magician.
That's incredible. Well, I noticed that my my two bushes have a kind of a limited number of blooms. So I wonder if the old blooms have...
No one
has been taking care of these bushes for years.
Absolutely. The older that growth gets, the less bloom it's going to put on.
You're
going to
look like a magician, too.
Great.
It's like us. We get old and we lose... It's like us. We get old and we lose our bloom, right?
There we go.
So.
Thanks,
Jim. All right, well, thank you very much, guys.
Yeah, you bet. We have Jackie emailed us wondering if you know anything about the disease that impatiens are getting. Every year she plants 5 flats of impatiens as she's quite shaded. I have not had a problem in the past. Should I be spraying them with a fungicide? How often should I treat?
I'd be surprised you can even find them this year. Pretty much all of the growers have quit growing. And it's impatiens walleriana, the sort of common standard impatiens. It's not at this point affecting like your double flowering, your New Guinea impatiens. And it is a powdery mildew. And it will wipe them out if you have them. So if you have found anybody that's actually selling them this year, probably wouldn't hurt to use a fungicide. We haven't ordered any in ourselves. We certainly don't want to have it or be promoting it in any way because it will spread. It's been my understanding that it's probably going to be hard to even find them this year. But just keep in mind, it's not all impatience.
Joyce in Chippewa Falls, hi.
Hi. I have a question about lily bulbs. I think they're called orientals. I have daylilies all over, but this is a totally different.
Correct. Daylily is not a true lily.
Okay.
So you have oriental lilies. Yep. We have them at the gardens.
Yep. And they're real tall. And they were here when I moved in. So I wanted to buy more because they were so beautiful and the deer wouldn't eat them. So I bought more of what I thought was the same thing, but they're like a foot shorter. So when they bloom, which is a little later than the tall ones, you still can't see them because of all the foliage. So I want to know if I can just do this switch. Bring the little ones to the front and the big ones to the back. And if that's possible, what time of year would I do it?
Okay. And that's if you want. Yeah, if you want the ideal time, I'd let them both bloom this year, and then I would make the switch around. Now, don't cut off any of that vegetation when you do it, because those bulbs are still going to want to photosynthesize and bring energy back into the bulb, particularly if you've moved them, and then let the vegetation die naturally.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Yeah, thanks, Joyce. And Nancy in Madison, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yes, hi. We go through this almost every spring about all the leaves that we just let lie on our, it isn't a lawn, it's more of a natural area that we're trying to nurture. But we have a Norway maple, a shagbark hickory, a red oak in the back. And does this count as mulch? Or I also heard that unless the leaves are finely ground up, that they're really... more noxious to the soil than if we just took them away and used some other sort of mulch.
Well, first let's define mulch is actually a term used for anything you're putting down on the ground, and leaves can be mulch, but it's more as something that's it's either adding to the soil or it's controlling weeds or moisture control. So let's talk in terms of what they really are. They are compost. Organic matter is what they are. And all leaves are compost and organic matter. And if you're not using it as a lawn, and this is a natural area, all those leaves that are dropping, they're doing exactly what they do in nature. And they're adding, as they break down, they're adding to the quality of your soils. Where people are concerned is if they're gardening and the leaf layer gets too thick, that's when they're advising you to chop them up because you just don't want big, dense layers of leaves because that might inhibit the growth of your plants. But even then, it's still compost. It's organic matter, very, very critical to a healthy soil. So again, if they're not interfering with anything, all you're doing is letting your yard do exactly what nature does.
It's and even supplying a little fertilizer. Those leaves actually...
Absolutely.
And then, in fact, it's one of the problems that exists in some forests now. Earthworms that are, I mean, you know, the worms we use for fishing are really...
non-native.
Yeah. Non-native and have been eating the leaf layers in several forests, especially out east. They've been losing a lot of forest because... all those leaves are gone, and the fertilizer or whatever use the leaves made are gone. So it's changing the nature of a forest.
Yep, and whenever you question about things, think about how it occurs in nature. And it's funny, we so many times all of a sudden we change our processes and procedures for the better, and we're like, oh, wait a minute, we're just taking it back to what nature does.
It's always fun to talk with Ed Lyon, director of the Allen Centennial Gardens on the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus. And I hope you'll just go and visit the gardens when you get a chance. It's really a lovely place, and you're going to feel like you're going to feel renewed when you visit it. Ed Lyon's our guest on Garden Talk. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller, along with my guest, Ed Lyon, today. Ed is director of the Allen Centennial Gardens on the University of Wisconsin campus in Madison. Great to have him along. We're having a wonderful conversation, and you can join it. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Chuck in La Crosse has a question for you, so let's go to him. Hi, Chuck.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Ed. I've got a telephone pole in the back corner of my yard, and I've got a hosta garden that comes down that side. It's the east side, and there's a fence there. And I'm looking for a vine that I could plant in that area that would kind of hide that telephone pole. You know, I could put up a screen of some kind and then plant that vine.
I did that once. The telephone company wasn't too happy with me once it reached the
top of the
pole.
Yeah, they don't want it on the pole.
okay, because I was going to say I did a trumpet vine on a telephone pole once, and it made it all the way to the top, and then they had to keep coming and cutting it out.
Yeah,
and trumpet vine will...
shaded area.
Oh, you're in the shade.
Yeah,
and
the hosta garden too.
Yep, and one of the best vines, well, certainly our native Parthenocissus, the quinquefolia, the Virginia creeper. You know, people knock the plant, but it's a native plant. It gets spectacular fall color, beautiful blue fruits. I still like the plant. We have it on our pergola at the gardens.
That's the Virginia creeper.
Our native Virginia creeper. Another ornamental plant that tolerates a fair amount of shade, but you're going to want to make sure that this is a good, rugged, durable arbor that you're putting it on, is the climbing hydrangea. And it is a true hydrangea. It's just in a vining form, beautiful exfoliating bark as it gets older. And it has a flattened hydrangea flower on it. Slow to start. The first 5 to 6 years, it doesn't put on a lot of growth. But then once it does, it becomes a very large and heavier vine. So this is not for that lightweight, cheap arbor.
Right.
You're going to want something solid.
Need a well-built one.
Correct.
Yep. The Virginia creeper, is that how does that grow fairly quick?
Very quick. Yeah,
very quick. Okay.
Yep. And it's the one, if you drive through the countryside in the fall and you see on old silos or sides of barns,
right,
this
okay.
beautiful scarlet vine with blue fruit, that's your Virginia creeper.
Yep.
Okay. Very easy to grow.
Because earlier I had planted a tree in front of the pole a good ways away, and unfortunately I planted an ash tree.
Oh.
And now we have problems with the ash borer. And I live off of a highway, and they just trim my ash tree like severely.
Oh, the emerald ash borer has been in your tree?
Not yet, no, but the highway department comes along and trims the trees along the road.
Yeah, sometimes they're worse than the ash borer.
The power company does.
Okay. Because they're now, for maybe $50 a year, you can control the emerald ash borer. So, okay. All right, so Virginia creeper sounds like a great idea to me, Ed.
And I haven't seen it recently in garden centers, but there is a variegated form of it called star showers. It's not as robust and much slower growing, and sometimes, you know, the variegation will do that in a plant. I haven't looked for it lately, but if you, you know, wanted to look for something with variegation, it's called star showers.
Okay.
All right.
Well, thank you, gentlemen.
Yep, thanks, Chuck. Appreciate the call. Well, Jill on Facebook wondered if a clamming hydrangea would grow in a high alkaline soil.
Well, we're very highly alkaline here, and they do quite fine for us, so that's no problem. I have a beautiful one at the gardens that's finally achieving some real height up a ponderosa pine. I have two at home. We're very highly alkaline here.
And let's see, we have Amy from... Hubertus. Oh, we actually talked about this. She was wondering a vine plant, a native vine plant that can tolerate shade.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, there we've kind of got that one covered, I think.
Yeah, unfortunately, there aren't a lot of vines that will take shade. If you're in a zone 5, there's also a vine much, it's Schizophragma, which is the Japanese hydrangea vine. That's also very nice, too. So that's another option. But if you're up in that zone 4, zone 3, that one won't work for you.
Lucy in Jefferson, thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I have in my, where I have my bushes planted in front of my house, and there's some hostas there too. We took down an elm tree probably 2, maybe 3 years ago, and there's all this fungus growing all over the place. It's like in clumps.
Yep, and that's not at all harmful. That's part of the whole decaying process. It's a very natural process. The fungus in nature are part of what are now breaking that the residual of the tree down. You may get morels.
Yeah.
But no, I think people think anytime they see anything fungal, it's all bad, and it's not. It's many of these fungal growths are part of our natural biological system, and they're just one more system that's aiding and breaking down and turning that into compost for you.
Okay, but they're ugly. can I get rid of them? Or how should I get rid of them?
Well, once they're dry, they're going to disappear because because they require moisture, and they're fairly short lived. They'll turn into or generate and break down and release their spores. They won't be there very long.
Okay, and will they come back more so next year?
If you have a dry year, you may not see them at all. It all depends on the year and, again, what it is that they're...
What's left you've got for roots.
What's left there that particular... Because all of these fungi are specific. And when it comes to the point where there's not the food source for it, it's already broken down, then there's nothing,
They're gone.
They're gone.
Yep.
Okay.
And maybe, just to redefine your idea of what's ugly. It's a natural occurring thing. And we're all gardeners.
Spray paint them, maybe.
there you go,
Lucy. Thanks for calling.
Yes, okay. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Oh, man. Gloria in Madison. Hi, thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you. I have, the winter, of course, has been very hard on plants, and I have a basswood, and it's like 3/4 yellow. I actually sent a picture on email.
You did?
Now, do you mean basswood or boxwood?
Oh, wait a minute. It's a shrub.
No, that would not be basswood. That's your American linden, a very big tree. Boxwood, of course, got anything that was exposed to above the snow line got severely damaged on boxwood this year.
Yeah, and so can it be saved, or do I have to?
Do you have green?
I have some green a little bit around, you know, the bottom.
If you're telling me a little bit and it doesn't sound like very much, you're probably better off to replace the plant.
Okay.
Most people on our boxwood, we have a parterre of boxwood in our French garden at the gardens, and we had no damage because it was entirely under snow all winter long.
Oh.
What most people are finding is anything then that was above is brown and it is dead. And you can go through and just cut that off. But if all you have is a very little bit of green down at the bottom, it's going to take you much longer time to ever regenerate that to any kind of size than probably just going out and replacing it would.
Okay.
It all depends on quantity, of course.
Okay. And I heard Larry, as I was waiting, to say something about treating the ash trees.
Correct. Yes. For emerald ash borer.
Emerald ash borer. So can you just go to your regular garden center and they'll help you out with what you need to do?
There's a drench material that you can apply. There's a little bit of math involved because you have to find the circumference of the tree, and the amount that you put on it is based on how big the tree is, of course. And I'm blanking on it's a permethrin, a type of permethrin that is drenched into the soil and actually works for about 12 months.
Okay.
And you should be able, if you go to a garden center, they should know. It's going to probably cost you around $50
okay.
a tree.
Yeah, I'm not sure it'll be in the big box store.
No, so, no, I wouldn't, no.
And I advocate to patronize your local independent garden centers anyway.
Right, right, yeah.
Or if you know a farmer, then it's probably get it the same thing for about $5.
Yeah, exactly.
To be perfectly honest.
Okay, well, I'll cultivate that relationship.
All right, thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Actually, you visit a co-op, you might, you know.
Yep, we have a farm co-op right down in Oregon. I shop there all the time.
Yeah. Kathy in Madison, your turn. Hi, Kathy.
Yes, hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have an extensive wildflower garden in my backyard, and I've had it for over 20 years, and I've kept the garlic mustard at bay. That's not why I'm calling. We live next to a pond near a conservancy, and it's this jewel weed that has this hollow stem.
Yes, I like jewel weed. We called it touch me not when we were kids because when it forms that little seed pod and you touch it, it explodes. It's an impatience is what it is.
Well, it has a very hollow stem and it pulls out just real easily.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But it's an invasive for you.
It is an invasive. The city has taken some of those trees and things out by the side of the pond and it's just filled in even worse with jewel weeds or whatever, touch me not. And then it comes over and it's just all over the place. It used to just be in one corner near where the pond is, but now it's gone all over the whole backyard. And I pull it out every day, hundreds and hundreds of them. Is there any way I can get rid of that?
I think pulling is probably going to be your option. Especially if it's coming up through wildflowers. So anything that you're going to try to kill it with, you're going to also kill your wildflowers, and you don't want to do that.
You don't want to spray anything there.
No.
Yep. So that's really your option is pulling. The good news is it's very easy to pull.
Well, that is good news. I know that. It seems to have just taken over this whole area in the conservancy area, too, when they cleared out. So, the other question, I'd be happy to give some of my Virginia creeper away. Of course, that's a natural thing, too, isn't it? But I've got a little too much of it. I have to pull that out later. And then I made the mistake of putting some snow in the mountain in one place. Is there any way you can get rid of that without just getting rid of everything around it?
Now, when you say snow in the mountain, are you talking Agapodium, the goutweed, the variegated, aggressive?
Yes.
Is that what you're talking? Yeah, that's very, very difficult to get rid of because when you dig it out, it just leaves little pieces of roots that re-root. That's one that you can work for years and years to eradicate and is very difficult to completely eradicate.
Look at it this way, Kathy. It's you've got years and years of exercise ahead of you.
Oh, well, I know that.
That one, you know, I don't like using herbicides, but that's the only, probably the only way you're judicious application, make sure you're doing the right concentration, putting it on at the right time, the temperatures, follow instructions very, very specifically.
But the myrtle underneath it, though, when I do that.
What's that?
It kills the myrtle underneath it when I try
And very often, and we have times at the gardens where we'll renovate a whole area, and that may mean literally taking up both plants, the myrtle and the weedy plant, and separating it all out and replanting it. Unfortunately, sometimes that's part of gardening, is it may take a total renovation.
Yep.
Yeah, I just wanted a reinsurance about that.
Okay.
Okay. Well, good luck with it, Kathy, and thank you so much for calling. I appreciate your call. I want to give Drew a chance to join us from Madison. Drew, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I have two questions. You may have answered the first one. It has to do with winter kill for ewes. I have one ewe that's probably 30, 40 years old, massive, and it's almost totally brown. So I'm wondering... It's a trim job, or is it down to the bottom?
Yeah, it doesn't sound good if it's almost totally brown. It should, you know, it should be showing you some green. Now, the ewes have not been pushing out any new growth yet, and that's what we're waiting for on our hedge. But if you've got one that's almost totally brown, that's not sounding good at all. Again, it certainly isn't hurting anything to wait a couple of weeks, you know, keep it watered. But if you're more brown than you're green, that's not a good sign.
That's not good.
Yeah. So related to that, I've also heard that placing Epsom salts around some trees and bushes is healthy for them in some degree. Is that correct or not?
The only thing I've ever used Epsom salts on are tomato plants, and that was for the magnesium. I've never heard of using it on trees. I don't think your trees should need it. In fact, you might be more likely to harm them. My policy on trees, shrubs, and perennials is I might fertilize them a little bit the first year to give them a start. After that, I never fertilize them again because you're trying to get them to send out roots to make a good root system, and they're not going to do that if you're supplying all that fertility to them. They should be doing that on their own, and unless then you find a very specific deficiency. And that's the only reason that I could see that somebody would say throw some Epsom salts on if it had either manganese or magnesium deficiency. And you don't see that I've ever seen.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks very much for calling. And in the last few seconds, somebody wondered about treating weeds along a weed killer that could be used near a lake or near water. Is there anything that you can recommend?
That's well out of my area of expertise. Yeah. I would certainly talk to Extension, maybe even DNR. Yeah. It might be DNR controlled, and they're going to restrict what you do use.
There are some things that can be used, but...
Yeah, but that's just not something I feel qualified enough to tell somebody. Certainly work with your cooperative extension agent. And again, it might be something you, depending on where your waterway is, you might want to check with the DNR as well.
Ed, it's always a great pleasure. Thank you so much. Ed Lyon, director of the Allen Centennial Gardens on the UW-Madison campus, and he'll be back again, and we'll talk with him again. Certainly, it was a great show today. I really enjoyed it. Thanks for listening. Stay with us on the Ideas Net.